KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Now, I may do it, I may not do it. I mean, nobody knows what I'm going to do. I can tell you this, that Iran's got a lot of trouble.
President Trump says nobody knows his plans for Iran. He's weighing strikes as Iran vows never to surrender.
It's Wednesday, June 18th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead this hour, lessons from the last time the U.S. attacked a Middle Eastern country to stop it from getting nuclear weapons.
Also, new research on teenagers who are addicted to their phones.
These youths are significantly more likely to report suicidal behaviors and thoughts.
And what's happening to kids who've relied on money from PEPFAR, the U.S.'s global HIV/AIDS program.
Sometimes we just have one meal per day. Diana is going to school without food. We are not okay.
The story of one child and a pastor's quest to help her.
Now News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. In an interview with NPR, Israeli President Isaac Herzog is calling for international support in destroying Iran's main nuclear facilities. President Trump says he's not made a decision whether to take part in attacking Iran. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli President Isaac Herzog told NPR it's up to President Trump whether the U.S. strikes Iran.
We would welcome anything that helps eradicate the Iranian nuclear program completely, including the main two sites at Fordo and Natanz. We are doing it alone, and we hope that there will be further support by other nations.
The Israeli president said Israel decided to attack days ago after sharing intelligence with the U.S. about Iran's nuclear plans. The U.S. National Intelligence Director testified in March that U.S. intelligence officials did not think Iran was building a nuclear weapon. Trump has dismissed the assessment. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Jerusalem.
As President Trump contemplates possible military action against Iran, the Senate is slated to get a classified briefing early next week. NPR's Deidre Walsh reports most Senate Republicans say they back whatever decision President Trump makes in terms of eliminating the threat from Iran to Israel or the U.S.
Alabama GOP Senator Tommy Tuberville says nobody wants war, but Iran can't have a nuclear weapon.
I'm all for what the president decides, because he knows a lot more about it than any of us. So if he does that, he's going to do it for a reason.
But Virginia Democratic Senator Tim Kaine is pushing a resolution, asking the president to seek approval from Congress before taking military action against Iran. He says Israel should be the one taking the lead, not the U.S.
There's just no need for us to be doing this. And I say this as a guy who votes for all the Israel aid packages.
Kaine's resolution is expected to get a vote next week, likely after top defense and intelligence officials brief senators. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, the Capitol.
Emergency personnel in Kyiv have pulled more bodies from the rubble of a nine-story apartment building demolished by a Russian missile. With the latest discovery, the death toll from an attack on the Ukrainian capital has now risen to 28. Authorities say 23 of those killed were inside the apartment building in a part of the city that took a direct hit. The overnight attack was among the biggest bombardments since the war began. Russia launched more than 400 drones and launched 32 missiles against the city. The Supreme Court has ruled in favor of temporarily allowing the storing of nuclear waste in rural Texas and New Mexico, though the country remains at an impasse over a more permanent solution. Justices reversing a federal appeals court ruling that invalidated the license granted by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to a private company for a Southwest Texas facility would also reinvigorate plans for a facility in New Mexico. On Wall Street, a mixed close. The Dow was down 44 points today. The Nasdaq closed up 25 points. This is NPR. President Trump's administration has asked a federal judge to strike down a Kentucky regulation it says unlawfully provides access to reduce in-state college tuition to students who do not have legal status in the U.S. Member station WEKU, Stan Ingold has more.
The U.S. Justice Department's lawsuit says that the regulation violates federal immigration law by enabling those who are in the U.S. illegally to qualify for reduced tuition at public colleges in Kentucky. It says American citizens from other states have to pay higher tuition rates to attend the same schools. The Trump administration took a similar action in Texas as part of its efforts to crack down on immigration. Both lawsuits follow recent executive orders aimed at stopping any state or local laws or regulations that, quote, discriminate against legal residents. For NPR News, I'm Stan Ingold in Richmond, Kentucky.
A growing number of U.S. companies are allowing their employees to decide how to spend their health care dollars, in some cases even to purchase their own coverage as part of what are known as individual coverage reimbursement arrangements. Advocates say the approach provides small companies that could not afford insurance the ability to offer something to workers, can also help employers cap rising health care costs. The approach, similar to a 401k-type retirement plan, places the risk for making the right choice on the employee. Crude oil futures prices rose for a sixth straight day as traders worry about possible supply disruptions from the Iran-Israeli conflict in the Middle East. Oil up 30 cents a barrel to $75.14 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Will the U.S. get involved in the deadly fighting between Israel and Iran? Earlier today, President Trump refused to rule it out.
I have ideas as to what to do, but I haven't made a final. I like to make the final decision 1 second before it's due, you know, because things change, I mean, especially with war.
One of the central questions here is how close Iran is to having a nuclear weapon. Trump has dismissed his own spy chief's assessment about the threat. Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard testified to Congress in March that Iran was not building a nuclear weapon, but on Air Force One yesterday, Trump said, "I don't care what she said, I think they were very close to having it." The president's insistence that a hostile country is building a weapon of mass destruction echoes the case another president made more than 20 years ago, when George W. Bush argued in 2002 that Iraq was building weapons of mass destruction.
It possesses and produces chemical and biological weapons. It is seeking nuclear weapons.
Those claims turned out to be inaccurate. No such stockpiles were found after the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Steve Call covered that war, and his latest book is The Achilles Trap: Saddam Hussein, the CIA, and the Origins of America's Invasion of Iraq. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thanks, Ari. Glad to be here.
U.S. intelligence has been catastrophically wrong before on the status of a Middle Eastern country's nuclear ambitions and programs. So as someone who covered the drumbeat to the war in Iraq in 2003, how are you thinking about this moment with Iran?
Well, there are echoes and there are differences. Let's maybe start with the differences. There's a much deeper public and agreed body of evidence about Iran's nuclear capabilities. They have the ability to enrich and are, in fact, enriching uranium to levels that could be used with a little bit of tweaking for a bomb. Everybody agrees about that. The question is their intention. And here, intelligence gets a little bit murkier, but that is a difference from Iraq. In the case of Iraq, there was no evidence publicly available, despite intrusive inspections, that the Iraqis were carrying out active nuclear bomb work. It was only the assertion of intelligence analysts that they were.
And so if the available intelligence is one key difference, what do you see as the key similarities?
Well, some of it is the political use of intelligence to justify a war, to articulate to publics in democratic societies, whether in Israel or in the United States, that, oh, we've got evidence that justifies this preemptive attack. You're going to have to trust us. That sounds similar, even though we can see, in the case of Iran, a much clearer and longer explicit nuclear program. Nonetheless, the threshold decision to attack is based on intelligence, so that's similar. And there's a second similarity that struck me over the last few days in particular, which is the disconnection between war aims and credible means to achieve those aims.
What do you mean by that? What is the aim here? And I take it you think the credible means are not available.
Yeah, well, let's start with the question. What are those aims? It's not clear. Israel has acted preemptively to stop Iran from breaking out and building a weapon at an unacceptable pace. And that was the first and remains an important part of Israel's explanation for why it had to attack. At the same time, Prime Minister Netanyahu has talked about regime change, has called upon the Iranian people to take matters into their own hands, a call that echoes one that George H.W. Bush made in early 1991 when he called on the Iraqi people to rise up against Saddam Hussein. And that didn't end well because the aim of fomenting an internal rebellion was not matched by any ability of the United States to support the rebels. Here too, no one is expecting the United States or Israel to launch a ground invasion of Iran and topple its governments. And yet there's talk, loose talk, about regime change as the goal of the entire operation.
What do you make of the disconnect between Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard saying Iran is not building a nuclear weapon and President Trump apparently deciding he knows differently?
Well, it sounds like Director Gabbard is articulating a judgment that has been publicized in the recent past, a judgment of American intelligence that Iran has not made an explicit decision to go all the way towards building a weapon. It sounds as if Israel is reporting that their intelligence is of a different character. And this seems to explain the gap between the president and his director of national intelligence. Ms. Gabbard is reporting what we understand to have been a longstanding U.S. judgment, and the president may be listening to his allies in Tel Aviv who are telling him, well, you got to get up to date with what we've learned.
In the run-up to the Iraq War, Secretary of State Colin Powell famously told President Bush that what he called the Pottery Barn rule applied in the war. If you break it, you own it. Do you think that principle is relevant here?
Well, the Iraq War, after all, was a ground invasion. So once American forces reached Baghdad and chased Saddam Hussein out of his palace, they were the occupying power and they owned the country. And we all remember the unhappy result that unfolded, I think. The analogy here is probably closer to the intervention in Libya, because that was just a bombing campaign. It was undertaken for limited purposes. But it set off a chain reaction that neither President Obama, who ordered American participation, nor many of the other allies in Europe and the Arab world who participated in the intervention could foresee. It resulted in a very complex civil war that's in some ways still going on today, more than a decade later. So these kinds of interventions may start out with limited aims, but our recent experience in the Middle East and elsewhere is that they don't always end there.
Do you think an off-ramp is likely, or does the momentum seem to be moving in the wrong direction?
I think the key question for me now is, what is President Trump going to decide to do? Israel is managing its own foreign policy. They have, since the October 7th attacks, been quite forceful in taking their own security into their own hands. They've done that here. That's one path that the United States can't control. I think that's been demonstrated. What it can control is its own intervention and how far it goes. And I think, as the president said today, nobody knows what I'm going to do. And that sounds like that includes himself.
That's journalist Steve Call, who is now with The Economist. Thank you.
Thanks, Ari. Thanks for having me.
President Trump says he's going to give TikTok another reprieve. Congress banned the popular video app last year unless it spun off from its Chinese owner ByteDance. Well, today the Trump administration announced that the president will pause enforcement of that ban by 90 more days. NPR's tech correspondent John Ruich is here with more. Hi there.
Hey there.
So, John, if I'm keeping score here, this is the third extension so far, right?
That's right. The White House has been, you know, trying to work out a deal where ByteDance sells a majority stake in TikTok to a consortium of U.S. companies. But it's been complicated, in part by geopolitics. You know, U.S.-China relations are tense. It's widely believed that ByteDance needs the Chinese government sign off for any kind of a deal, and that hasn't been forthcoming. So Trump issued a 75-day reprieve when he took office and a second in April. And today he says he'll give the company another extension. He told reporters that he thought there probably would be a deal and that it would need China's blessing. There are just a lot of questions, though. You know, the White House put out a statement saying Trump doesn't want the app to go offline, but we haven't seen an executive order yet, and the current one expires tomorrow. I also emailed TikTok to get their take and haven't heard back.
Okay, this sounds a little bit complicated, so if you can, just remind us how we got here.
Sure. The two big factors to keep in mind that have propelled this are, one, TikTok is hugely popular in the U.S. As of early last year, about half of the people in the United States were on it. The second point is that it's owned by a Chinese company, and as relations with China have soured, American politicians have really become worried that TikTok could be used by Beijing to collect data on Americans or to influence them. Trump actually tried to ban TikTok by executive order during his first term. That was blocked by a court. But during the Biden administration, Congress rallied bipartisan support to pass a law that gave ByteDance a chance to sell TikTok. If it didn't, the ban would kick in on January 19th this year, which was Biden's last full day in office.
What has TikTok's take been on all of this?
Well, TikTok fought that all the way to the Supreme Court. They called the law unconstitutional and said it violated free speech, but the court sided with Congress. As that deadline approached, TikTok took itself offline, but the president-elect Trump, promised to pause enforcement of the law, so it returned. Then on Inauguration Day, Trump signed an executive order for that first 75-day delay.
Can the president just delay enforcement of a law like this using executive orders?
Yeah, I emailed the White House to ask about that and haven't heard back from them. On Air Force One on Tuesday, Trump was asked if he had legal basis and said yes. Some legal experts dispute that. You know, the TikTok law allows for one 90-day extension, and only if the president certifies to Congress that a spinoff from ByteDance is in the works. Here's Ryan Calo. He's a law professor at the University of Washington who follows tech.
This president is not operating within Congress's intent. It sets a bad precedent wherein the president feels like he can simply ignore a congressional statute.
He also says that it's risky for companies like Apple and Google, which offer TikTok on their app stores.
Well, what problems could those companies face?
Well, the law stipulates that companies that work with TikTok could face extremely steep fines. For now, Trump has been ordering the Justice Department not to enforce the ban, but experts say there are no guarantees. You know, so companies like those could potentially face legal dangers down the line. We reached out to Apple and Google to ask them about it. Haven't heard back yet. I should note that both are financial supporters of NPR.
NPR tech correspondent John Ruich, thank you.
You bet.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from The Station and from Subaru and its retailers, partnering with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society this June to give blankets and messages of hope to patients facing cancer. Learn more at subaru.com/care. From RBC Wealth Management, where financial advisors work to understand individual goals and are dedicated to providing customized advice to help strengthen financial security. More at rbcwealthmanagement.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Years ago, under the George W. Bush administration, the U.S. decided to put a lot of money into helping orphans, AIDS orphans. The disease had left some 12 million children without a parent, mostly in Africa. But early this year, the Trump administration halted most foreign assistance, including much of the AIDS orphans program. In an email, the State Department commented that the program is under review. NPR's Gabriela Emanuel has the story of what these abrupt changes could mean for one child and a pastor's quest to help her.
Night had fallen hours before, but Pastor Billions Chandwe was not slowing down. On February 20th, he frantically recorded voice messages on WhatsApp and dialed distant acquaintances from his home in Zambia.
I called the whole night, calling everyone and anytime.
He urgently needed to find HIV medication for a 9-year-old AIDS orphan. Her name is Diana. He sent a voice message to an old friend.
Calvary greetings, Dr. Susan, how are you?
Susan Hillis listened to the message in the airport check-in line in Thailand. She was heading back to the U.S. from a conference of Christian mission hospitals. As she listened, she learned that the U.S. cuts to foreign aid meant Diana's HIV clinic in rural Zambia had closed without warning. Diana was born with HIV, and she takes medicine to keep the virus at bay. Hillis could hear the worry in Pastor Billy's voice.
I had tears in my eyes and was choked up.
Hillis spent years working on Bush's HIV/AIDS initiative, and she'd seen the dramatic relief it had brought to sub-Saharan Africa, increasing life expectancy, decreasing infection rates. But with the shutdown in foreign aid, Hillis thought Diana was in trouble.
She has no chance unless someone can get her medicine in the middle of rural Zambia. Who's going to do that? I was thinking she's going to die. She is going to die.
She dug into her Rolodex and pulled out a few names for Pastor Billy. They traded voice messages.
We pray hope is given to Diana. We trusting that God will make a way.
Pastor Billy continued working the phones into the wee hours of the morning.
Then by chance, it's a miracle.
He found someone who said yes, they would share the remaining pills with the girl.
They'll give Diana for 5 days. They'll share.
Even with this little reprieve, Pastor Billy worries these pills could be the wrong dosage for Diana.
God save Diana that she doesn't develop symptoms because the dosage was too much or was less.
For decades, Pastor Billy and his wife have been helping orphans. They've welcomed more than 15 into their home, raising them alongside their 5 kids. For a brief period, Diana was one of them.
Diana, something that gives me sleepless nights.
And that's because he's seen her through so many hard times. There was the house fire, Diana's HIV diagnosis, her mother's death from AIDS, her grandmother's death from COVID. But it was clear to Billy, Diana's future was in trouble.
Diana, if left, she was supposed to be a street kid, just staying on the street.
But Pastor Billy and his wife were determined not to let that happen to her. Even when the church moved them to a town far from Diana, they stayed involved in her life. Over the years, often driving the 4 hours to visit her. Since the aid withdrawal, those trips have intensified. Pastor Billy knows that Diana is now more vulnerable than ever. Plus, every week or so, he has to scramble to find HIV meds for her. On a recent Wednesday, he's barreling down the highway once again on the way to Diana's. His windshield wipers slap away rain. Pastor Billy's phone erupts now and again with calls from parishioners. Like Diana, they too have watched their U.S.-funded HIV clinics close without warning. And without their meds, they tell Pastor Billy they're getting sick.
It's very difficult. Yeah.
These calls take Pastor Billy back to the days before the U.S. made AIDS medications available across Africa. It was a time when so many were dying from AIDS that Pastor Billy's own congregation dwindled. And more than that, Pastor Billy lost someone very close to him.
Her name was Charity.
Charity was Billy's twin sister. Growing up, they were inseparable. They shared secrets. They insisted on eating meals together.
Yeah, we eat from the same plate. We were so close. Yeah, it was just lovely.
When they were 17, Charity got sick with AIDS, and it was Billy who nursed her for almost 2 years.
What I felt was I'm alone. It brought me to my knees. No matter what I can do as a human being, there is a limit. I think it's a point I turned to God.
And turning to God eventually led Billy to become a pastor. He says out of his faith grew his devotion to helping others also scarred by AIDS, and where he could, saving them from his own sister's fate. A few blocks from Diana's house, we pass her clinic.
Yeah, so now it's closed. There's no one working.
Even though the U.S. has said HIV treatment can continue, many people still can't find their meds. Pastor Billy pulls up to the home. Sitting on an upside-down bucket in the dusty front yard is Diana. Her face lights up, a skinny 9-year-old with a frilly skirt and short-cropped hair. He gives her a big hug. She calls him father. Pastor Billy's main mission this trip is to figure out Diana's meds. But when he arrives, he sees that far more is in turmoil. Outside the front door, Jennifer Makuka is cooking a pot of greens over a coal fire. She's Diana's foster mom.
Sometimes we just have one meal per day. Diana is going to school without food. Yeah, we are not okay.
They used to get food assistance through the U.S. program for AIDS orphans. Some beans, a bit of fish. Now that's all stopped. Diana says she's noticed the difference. Because there isn't enough food, Diana says, she often feels very sick after taking her HIV meds, when she has them. Since the freeze on foreign aid, her foster mom has spent many days going to Zambian government clinics trying to get Diana meds. But they get just an emergency pack, pills for a few days or a couple weeks. Mukuka says sometimes Diana goes without them altogether. Standing quietly, Pastor Billy watches as Diana gets ready for school. He seems worried. He says he's realizing that without U.S. help for AIDS orphans, without the extra food, the guarantee of AIDS medication, Mukuka can't really support Diana, not on her own. In her brown school uniform, Diana's packing her book bag.
And this is my bag, and the ruler and pen.
She's ready for her 20-minute walk to school. It's on that walk, she says, that she often dreams about becoming a doctor. She pictures herself in a white coat with a stethoscope around her neck. Then Pastor Billy and Diana hug goodbye, and she starts down the dusty path. One very special girl, and yet, Pastor Billy says, there are millions of AIDS orphans just like her. He gets in his car for the drive back home, wondering what to do next. Gabriella Emanuel, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Some communities are scaling back Juneteenth celebrations because they worry about the risk of racial violence.
Given the nationwide climate, we are heavily about making sure that people are safe.
The challenges of Juneteenth and the latest on the war between Israel and Iran. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Billions of moths migrate each spring to a spot in the Australian Alps that they've never visited before. How do they know where to go?
It's the first time that we have found an invertebrate using the stars to navigate.
Moth navigation after the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The Pentagon is providing options to President Trump as he decides the next steps on Iran and whether to assist with Israeli airstrikes, an action that could draw America into a wider war in the Middle East. That's something Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia says would put U.S. service members in the line of fire.
There are sources both in Israel and in the White House and in Congress really urging the president to join in a full-scale war against Iran. But there's also sources in the White House and here in Congress that are saying to the president, please do not do this. A third war in the Middle East in this century would be a horrible, horrible mistake, and it's going to put U.S. service members at risk.
Kaine says Senate Republicans are loyal to the president, but should remember what he's said in the past, that forever wars in the Middle East are over. Home building is slumping amid economic uncertainty and high mortgage rates, as NPR's Laura Walmsley tells us. The latest figures show a decline in housing starts and builder confidence.
Housing starts dropped nearly 10% in May. The drop-off was concentrated in buildings with five or more units, which declined 30% compared to a month earlier. Those figures are from the Census Bureau and the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Permits and starts for single-family homes rose slightly last month, but builders are worried about the future. A survey by Wells Fargo and the National Association of Home Builders found that confidence among single-family home builders dropped another 2 points this month to one of the lowest readings since 2012. With more homes for sale than buyers in many markets, nationally, it's been a slow spring for existing home sales. Laurel Walmsley, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks finished mixed on Wall Street. The Dow lost 44 points. This is NPR. The UN World Food Program says it's only been able to bring into Gaza about 400 trucks of food in the past month. That compares to as many as 600 trucks per day during a short-lived ceasefire earlier this year. The UN warns of the risk of famine. Here's NPR's Aya Batrawi.
Gaza's health ministry says 140 people were killed in Israeli attacks over the past 24 hours, making it the second deadliest day since Israel broke a ceasefire in March. At least half of those killed, the ministry says, were people trying to get food. Some were killed waiting for aid trucks. Others were shot dead trying to reach sites distributing some food under a new Israeli plan restricting its distribution. Dr. Mark Brunner, an emergency physician from Oregon, is volunteering at a hospital flooded by casualties.
It's, you know, day after day. You know, every time we know that there's a so-called food distribution, we know that there's going to be annihilation.
Israel's military says it's fired warning shots at crowds and that some incidents are under review. Aya Batrawi, NPR News, Dubai.
President Trump says he will probably extend a deadline for TikTok's Chinese owners to divest from the popular video sharing app. White House says he doesn't want to see TikTok go dark. Trump signed an order back in April to keep the popular app running for an additional 75 days after a potential deal to sell the video app to American owners was put on hold. The new extension will last for 90 days. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. When it comes to social media and teen mental health, we often talk about screen time. A new study finds it's not how much time they spend on social media, but how addicted kids are that is tied to their mental health and suicide risk. NPR health correspondent Ritu Chatterjee has been covering this. Hi, Ritu.
Hi, Mary Louise.
So I do want to get into the findings in just a sec, but I am interested in how researchers figured this out. Would you describe how they conducted the study?
Yeah, so they used data on more than 4,000 kids from a really well-known long-term study called ABCD, or Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Study. And it's been following these kids for several years, starting at ages 9 and 10. Mm-hmm. And researchers collected data on the kids' average daily screen time, and they assessed their addiction to social media, smartphones, and video games using this standardized questionnaire. Here's Yunyu Xiao at Weill Cornell Medicine. She's one of the authors of the new study that was published in JAMA. And she says, here are the kinds of statements in that questionnaire.
I cannot stop using my phone. I feel the need of using social media more and more. I feel like social media apps use it all the time so that I can forget about my problems.
So, you know, Xiao and her colleagues then used the responses from the kids to sort of gauge how addicted they were to their devices and social media over 4 years of the study. And then they look for any link with mental health symptoms, especially thoughts and attempts of suicide that the kids and their parents reported over the course of the study.
And what did they find?
So by the time the kids turned 14, a surprisingly large proportion of the kids were highly addicted to social media, their smartphones, and video games. And it was the kids with high and growing levels of addiction that had that higher risk of saying that they had struggled with suicide thoughts, that made plans and even attempted.
Ritu, that is, it's so striking. It's so sad. And I can't help but wonder if part of the problem is that we, the adults trying to help teenagers navigate all this, so many of us are addicted to our phones too.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is something that psychologist Mitch Prinstein at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, brought up when I talked to him. And here's what he suggests.
I think one of the first steps is acknowledging the hard truth that it's not just kids that feel this way. And parents might need to acknowledge, you know, sometimes it's hard for me too. So let's talk about what we can do as a family to support each other.
And, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics suggests having a family media plan. One pediatrician I spoke with who specializes in adolescent screen time suggests having screen-free times, especially at bedtime, because it affects sleep and therefore mental health, and also during family meal times, so parents have that time for bonding and conversations and check in with their teens on what's happening in their lives online and offline. And that's good for teen mental health, too.
And for grown-up mental health, too. And Pierce Ritu exactly. Chatterjee. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
And if you or someone you know is struggling with thoughts of suicide, you can call or text the Suicide Crisis Lifeline, 988.
The U.S. Supreme Court today upheld laws in roughly half the states that ban gender-affirming care for transgender minors. The vote was 6-3 along ideological lines. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
The case was brought by transgender children and their parents in Tennessee, who claimed that the state's ban on hormone treatments and puberty blockers for trans minors discriminated on the basis of sex. They contended they were being denied equal protection of the law because the same medications that are banned for minors with gender dysphoria are permitted for other minors with conditions such as early or late onset puberty. But today, Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for the conservative court's supermajority, rejected that argument entirely. He said that laws like Tennessee's that turn on age or medical use are not subject to the kind of heightened legal scrutiny that courts use to look at workplace sex discrimination, for instance. Instead, the court in this case applied the lowest level of legal scrutiny called rational basis, meaning that if there's any rational justification for the law, it passes constitutional muster. Acknowledging what he called the fierce scientific and policy debates about the safety, efficacy, and propriety of medical treatments in an evolving field, Roberts said that it is not the court's job to judge the wisdom or fairness of Tennessee's law. The court's job, he said, is only to determine whether the law violates the Constitution's guarantee to equal protection of the law. Having concluded that it does not unconstitutionally discriminate, he said, we leave these policy questions to the people, their elected representatives, and the democratic process. Reaction to the decision was swift.
It's a devastating decision.
Jennifer Levi is a senior director at GLAAD Law, an advocacy organization for LGBTQ rights.
There's no sugarcoating this opinion. It means that in the more than half the states where the care is banned, families won't be able to get the care that their children need. The court really abdicated its responsibility to protect a vulnerable group.
In a rare dissent from the bench today, Justice Sonia Sotomayor echoed that sentiment. Because the Tennessee law explicitly classifies its ban on the basis of sex and transgender status, she said, the court is required to use a higher level of scrutiny. Instead, she said, the majority contorts logic and precedent to say otherwise, retreating from meaningful judicial review exactly when it matters most. Because the court abandons children and their families to political whims, she said, in sadness, I dissent. Joining her in full was Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, with Justice Elena Kagan partially joining too. Kagan would have required a higher level of scrutiny, but she would have stopped there. Given the extensive and disputed evidence presented in the lower court, she said, the court should have sent the case back to the lower courts to determine whether the state law was based on stereotypes and prejudices or legitimate state interests. While the court's majority opinion gave states broad powers to ban or regulate transgender medical care for minors, it left unresolved a number of related questions that very likely will reach the Supreme Court next term. Among them is a challenge to the Trump administration's ban on transgender people in the military, and a challenge to the Trump administration's policy denying passports for transgender individuals unless they list their sex at birth. Also not resolved by today's ruling are state bans on transgender athletes participating in school sports. Federal law bars discrimination based on sex in any educational program or activity that receives federal funding. Here's John Bursch, who argued and won today's case on behalf of the Conservative Alliance Defending Freedom.
About half the states have adopted the Save Women's Sports laws, and they prohibit boys who identify as girls from being on the girls' sports team.
As he notes, challenges to two of those state laws are now pending before the Supreme Court. Farther down the road, he says, is another question, whether states can ban medical care for transitioning adults.
I think there would be a rational basis to also prohibit it for adults, and that will be up to the states to decide.
The court will be back Friday with more opinions. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered. Omaha, Nebraska celebrated Juneteenth even before President Biden declared it a national holiday, remembering when federal troops came to Galveston and told Texans that slavery was over. That was more than 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. But this is the first year that Nebraska's largest city will celebrate with a black mayor. Here's Nebraska Public Media's Cassidy Arena.
Volunteers are preparing historic 24th Street in Omaha, Nebraska for this year's Juneteenth parade. Frankie Jean Williams is the chair of the Omaha NAACP Juneteenth Celebration Committee. She's looking forward to seeing the city's first elected black mayor in the lineup.
It's a sense of pride. It's a wonderful opportunity to show young people the value of their vote.
In May, Democrat John Ewing Jr. won the mayoral election of Nebraska's largest city, ousting the 12-year Republican incumbent. Williams wants Mayor Ewing to sit in a convertible for the parade, but she knows he'll probably want to walk.
Just to see him sitting there at that moment, I'm sure for my generation will bring some tears, because you couldn't have told a lot of people that this would ever happen.
Omaha NAACP President T. Michael Williams says this year's celebration is a, quote, watershed moment.
The state of Nebraska, the city of Omaha, honestly has not always been kind to black people. And I think it's a great opportunity for us as a city to move forward.
Ewing is a former county treasurer in Nebraska. He's from North Omaha, an area with a large black population. He says his election has reinvigorated Omaha's Juneteenth celebration, and he believes Omaha can set an example for the nation.
We can be like the rest of the country and have all of the fighting and all of the anger and have that be counterproductive, or we can look at how we can be great together.
But some of that national tension has leaked into Omaha's celebration. Committee Chair Williams says some sponsors from previous years withdrew their support of the Juneteenth parade due to the Trump administration's rollbacks of diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives.
It wasn't surprising. It was a way out for them. They were doing something that they didn't want to do in the first place. It just shows true colors. And I definitely want people to know who pulled out, and I want people to know who stayed.
Williams says this will be Omaha's largest parade in terms of participants, though, and she has no plans to stop growing. She says she can foresee a day when Juneteenth is no longer considered a federal holiday, and that would make her work even more poignant.
You can't take our history away from us, whether it's a holiday or not.
The Trump administration has cracked down on DEI programs, saying they are illegal and discriminatory. June 19th was declared a federal holiday in 2021 under former President Joe Biden. But even before that designation, Omaha celebrated the day when the last enslaved African Americans in the South learned they were free. And organizers say they'll continue to do so, especially with the support from the new mayor. For NPR News, I'm Cassidy Arena in Omaha, Nebraska.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Federal Reserve is watching carefully to see if President Trump's tariffs rekindle inflation. With that in mind, the central bank held interest rates steady today. Policymakers did signal they still expect to cut borrowing costs later this year. NPR Chief Economic Correspondent Scott Horsley is in the studio. Hi, Scott.
Great to be here.
Great to have you with us. Okay, so this was pretty much what we were expecting, watching for the decision to keep rates where they are. There was still some drama, though, at today's Fed meeting. What happened?
That's right. Every other Fed meeting, we get not only the interest rate decision, but a forecast of what Fed policymakers expect to happen in the future. And as you say, there was not a lot of suspense around the rate decision today. Markets were pretty sure the central bank was going to stand pat, but all eyes were on that forecast. And what it tells us is that Fed policymakers still expect to be in a position to cut interest rates later this year by an average of about half a percentage point. That would make it cheaper to buy a car or finance a business or carry a balance on your credit card. Mm-hmm. Fed Chairman Jerome Powell says we're not there yet, but lower interest rates are in our future.
It's very, very hard to say when that will happen. We know that the time will come. As long as the economy is solid, though, as long as we're seeing the kind of labor market that we have and reasonably decent growth and inflation moving down, we feel like the right thing to do is to be where we are, where our policy stance is, and just learn more.
You know, the unemployment rate is quite low. It's been 4.2% for the last 3 months, so there's no real urgency to goose the economy by lowering rates.
Although, Scott, inflation has also been pretty tame for a few months now. Isn't that a reason to cut rates?
Yeah, inflation has come down a lot from its peak, but you know, the cost of groceries and big appliances is still going up faster than the Fed would like. And Powell and his colleagues are pretty sure we're going to see higher inflation this year as a result of President Trump's tariffs. You know, those import taxes are the highest in almost a century, and somebody has to pay that. Now, we haven't seen a lot of evidence of the tariff effect in either the April or the May inflation reports. Prices in May barely budged, but Powell says that doesn't mean we're out of the woods.
It takes some time for tariffs to work their way through the chain of distribution to the end consumer. A good example of that would be goods being sold at retailers today may have been imported several months ago before tariffs were imposed.
The other wild card, of course, is what happens in the Middle East. The fighting between Israel and Iran has pushed oil prices up, and retail gasoline prices have started inching up here in the U.S. Powell says usually those kinds of spikes are pretty short-lived and don't have lasting effects on inflation, but it is something the Fed's keeping an eye on.
Meanwhile, President Trump continues to needle the Fed. He wants them to lower interest rates. He is not going to let that go. Is it having any effect?
Not yet. You know, the president's been very critical of Powell for not cutting rates more aggressively. Just this morning, Trump went on a lengthy tirade about the Fed chairman. He wants lower rates not only to boost the economy, but also to make it cheaper for the federal government to finance its $36 trillion debt. You know, the interest on that debt alone is $776 billion this year, with 4 months to go in the fiscal calendar.
It's hundreds of billions. It's even trillions of dollars. That we're going to lose because of this too late. I call him Too Late Powell because he's always too late.
Now, Powell has shown a pretty thick skin and an ability to shrug off those attacks by the president. But Trump will have a chance to pick Powell's successor when the Fed chairman's term expires in just under a year.
And Pierre Scott Horsley, good to see you.
Good to be with you.
There's a kind of moth half the size of a credit card that flaps its way along a rather epic journey, but how does it know where to go? Well, science reporter Ari Daniel says researchers now have an answer.
The bogong moths of Australia are kind of plain.
They're small brown moths with arrow-like markings on the wings. They're pretty nondescript.
But these insects undertake a remarkable migration twice in their lifetime, says Andrea Adden, a neurobiologist at the Francis Crick Institute. The moths hatch in their breeding grounds in the spring in southeast Australia, where it gets really hot in the summertime.
So if they were to reproduce immediately, their larvae would starve because there is not enough food.
So the moths migrate over multiple nights more than 600 miles south to the Australian Alps, where they settle in cooler caves, millions of them.
It's just moth over moth over moth. You don't see any cave wall anymore. It's just moths.
In the fall, they return all the way back to their breeding grounds, mate, lay their eggs, and die.
And so then the next year, the new moths hatch, and they've never been to the mountains. They have no parents who can tell them how to get there.
And yet they make it. Her colleagues had shown that the Earth's magnetic field helps the moths orient.
But they couldn't use only the Earth's magnetic field. They needed something visual to go with it.
And Adden wanted to know, what might that cue be over such a vast landscape, especially at night when there's not that much light? Perhaps, she thought, the cue comes from the heavens.
The Milky Way is such a stunning sight, and it seemed an obvious thing to use if you are a moth living in that environment.
To test her theory, Adden, who was doing her PhD at Lund University in Sweden at the time, and her colleagues caught moths in the mountains and ran them through one of two experiments in the dead of night. The first was a behavioral test. It involved placing a moth inside what was basically a mini planetarium that contained a projection of the night sky. The results surprised them.
They didn't just circle and like do twists and turns, but they actually chose a fairly stable direction. But not only that, it was their migratory direction.
In other words, the moths were using the starry sky as a compass cue to orient and navigate. Adden's next question involved what was happening in the moth's tiny brain. So she recorded the electrical activity of individual neurons while rotating a projection of the Milky Way. And she found that the moth's brains encoded the direction by processing visual cues of the stars.
It's the first time that we have found an invertebrate using the stars to navigate.
The findings are published in the journal Nature. Paulina Fleischmann is a biologist at the University of Oldenburg who studies navigation in desert ants and wasn't involved in the research.
It shows that insects, their world is probably much more filled with information than humans usually assume.
And she says their ability to use both visual and magnetic information to navigate can be essential for survival in case it's cloudy, say, or the magnetic field is unreliable.
If one fails, they have a backup system.
And it's worth mentioning that the bogong moth is endangered. Andrea Adden says the findings could help conserve these insects and everything that relies on them for food.
Protecting the bogong moth would help us protect the entire alpine ecosystem.
She says that reducing light pollution is a first step in allowing these moths to continue following the stars across the Australian bush. Ari Daniel, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.